Hello, and welcome to another episode of Mike M's Weekly Reads. It's been a while since I've had time to record this, and I'm going to try to record a quick intro and then later on come back with weekly reads because I got home early from work, which is really weird for a Tuesday, but yep, sometimes that happens. So the first thing I wanted to talk about is I was recently sort of in a book. It's a book of shorts. And this book was done by a neighbor of ours that I used to know, three houses down from where I used to live in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Lived in the South Valley, mostly blue collar in that area. My dad was a fireman and my mom was a bookkeeper. And we were in that house. They're still in that house, but the neighbor I had run across many years ago, she now lives where her parents used to live, and she had stopped by because her daughter is friends with my niece, and she was over at the house at one point. And I guess seeing me again had me put into one of the shorts in her book. Her name is Judy Alderete Garcia, and she wrote a abstract of little shorts, abstracts of the South Valley Nuevo Mexicana. And it's really a fascinating piece of little shorts because these are like little snippets of things I sort of, there's things about green stamps, and I don't know if people know what they are, but back in the day, if you shopped at like Piggly Wiggly for groceries and stuff, you'd get these like green stamps, and you could like they counted for like something. So you'd get like a booklet and you'd put these stamps in, and if you collected enough stamps, you could actually get like a physical product at the green stamp store. And you could maybe get a toaster or something like that. It was a strange, promotional thing, but it was a lot of fun. And there's things in here about like the bookmobile, which is like a library, a public library on wheels, and it used to park, and we used to get books from that. That's like where I got a bunch of Dr. Seuss books and stuff like that. I ran into her several years ago, and she had me sing this song, and I didn't remember why I sang it to begin with, but it was called Seasons in the Sun. And it's that song. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun, but the wine and the song and this. Anyway, it's really pretty freaking depressing, and I don't know exactly what it is, but it sounds to me like it's about a guy that's leaving the world. And I always thought when I was young it was about a guy that was going to prison and get the electric chair, but I don't know why I came with that assumption, but this little snippet is called Seasons in the Sun, and I'm gonna read it. It says, Michael lived three houses down from our house. He played with the girls in the street and sang. I didn't realize when I was really young, like this is like kindergarten age, like five, but I didn't know anybody in the neighborhood, but I started to meet. Like there was a girl across the street. I think her name was Vicky, and then there was Judy and Jeanette, and we would play like stuff in the street, like kickball and just crazy stuff. But anyway, that's what it has, and she calls the Seasons in the Sun. One day Michael came and knocked on our front door and asked for Jeanette and me to play. When my mom said we couldn't play, he turned around slowly and started to walk away. But before my mom closed the door, she quickly said, "Stop! Wait! Don't go! There's a boy here who wants to play." And that boy was John, who was my best friend growing up. He was a year older than me. But Most of my best friends were either older, because they were in my neighborhood, they were 1 year older or 1 year younger. I did have a really, really good friend that was the same age, but that happened in high school. And we had like our backyards, if I look diagonal in the backyards, there was another guy that was my age that we went to elementary school together, junior high, and high school, and also he went to college at UNM. So, like, but we weren't like really close like that I was with John. But it says Michael and John played with their G.I. Joes, so you could kind of get like where we were at. And when these G.I. Joes, they were not your G.I. Joe, a real American hero. These were the G.I. Joe 12-inch dolls with the beard, because I'm old like that. And he said race cars, so we had like we did have race cars. We had the Hot Wheels racing tracks, and we had the Hot Wheels, and we also had Tyco race tracks. And what the Tyco race tracks were is you could pick like really cool cars, like a 57 Chevy and a Corvette. And they'd have this little prong on the bottom, and you attach them to this like electric racetrack that you would plug in to the outlet, and then you'd race these cars. You'd have like a trigger that had like a the more you press the trigger, the more gas you'd give. So you might want to let up on the gas around the curves, depending on how you would make track out of the any shape you wanted to based on this track. And then if you took the corners too fast, you'd like go off the track, your car prong would leave and you'd lose control. But it says Michael and John played with their G.I. Joe's race cars and with some really miniature plastic military men. And these military men, the plastic ones, like if you watch Toy Story, for example, there are these army men that are just like this dark green, and they're in different shapes. And those were the army men that she's talking about. And it says sometimes my mom got tired of seeing these men on the floor and passed the vacuum right over them. But John had some unique army men. I had the standard ones that you'd go to like get at a TGNY or a Kmart. But he had these ones that were like, I can't remember where he got them from. They're like from Santuario or something weird, some place. And they just had these like really unique shapes that the other ones didn't, and they were slightly bigger. But it says as they got older, John and Michael played baseball, football, and basketball late into the night at Michael's house or ours. And that's kind of what drove our friendship, was sports. I remember one of the first things we played is John had boxing gloves, and we boxed, and he used to beat the shit out of me. Like, I didn't even want to box because it was like he popped me in the nose and I was done. But I remember one time I knocked him the hell out because I was trying to cover up, with the glove so he wasn't hit my nose. And I did an uppercut on his jaw and like knocked him on his ass. But that was the only time. That was the only time I ever beat the crap out of him in boxing. But we would play all kinds of sports. We grew up doing Little League, Yaffle football. And so tackle football, flag football, and he was a year older, so I wasn't always in his competitive leagues. I was always 1 year later, but we'd always do stuff in the streets, and then we both had basketball courts in our front yard, and that's what led us to play basketball almost our entire time growing up. As a matter of fact, we played in leagues in middle school, and then when we graduated middle school, and he graduated middle school, he got into the high school freshman basketball team, and I got recruited into the high school basketball team as well, but I was 1 year behind him. So, yeah, we played a lot of basketball, and it was sort of our life for 4 years. It was even part of like this curriculum. Those that made the basketball team, their sixth period class was basketball. So that last hour of the day, you were practicing, and then that practice would go from like 3 to 4, and then you'd continue practicing from 5 to 7, and then your parents would have to come pick you up. And my parents got tired of that real fast. And when I turned 15, they were like, "You're going to driver's ed, and you're going to get a license because we're not going to drive you anymore." And I didn't really want to drive because I knew I was going to be one of the only ones that had a car. But and my friends were all going to be, "Take us here, take us there," and I was like, "I don't want to deal with that." But anyway, so it says, they played until they graduated from high school, which is true. And John joined the army, and Michael went away to college. And they said, "A few years ago, I saw Michael at his mom's house, and he sang 'Seasons in the Sun,' and I did it." And I forgot all about that. That I used to sing that song, but that was a favorite song of mine, and I don't know why, because it's such a dark song. Like, you should look it up if you get a chance on YouTube. But I thought that was an interesting story. And there's a lot of, vignettes about things that are real personal about me growing up in the South Valley, and just our school cafeteria, and just there are so much things, And it's really interesting. So if you get a chance and you're interested, check out Abstracts of a South Valley Nuevo Mexicana by Judy Garcia. And it's not that thick. It's a real small book. But anyway, I thought I'd mention that. And then I'm going to pause. So if we get into some questions, and I had to go actually listen to the last episode because I don't remember where I left off, and if I'm bad about like not removing the question, then I will repeat the question. So my first question is from Nick Wetmore, and it says, "I know how much you dig Steve Gerber. What title would you have loved to see him helm that he never wrote?" Steve Gerber was always good with like characters that couldn't talk or were political or were dysfunctional, like dysfunctional groups. So he tackled, Howard the Duck, which was a duck that was looking at our world and kind of speaking, I think, through his eyes. And then there was Man-Thing, who never talked, so all the stories would focus around the characters that were around Man-Thing and the situation that got them in touch with Man-Thing. And there was Defenders, which was the dysfunctional group of heroes that probably shouldn't have been a team. And the other one that he did was, what was that zombie one? It's Simon Garth, whatever that was. It was a magazine about a zombie, and this was like not the it was more of the voodoo zombie type. This Simon Garth was not a good person, and somebody put a curse on him to become a zombie, and it was him going through all these situations, and he couldn't really communicate or anything, but he was sort of there. And all the situations, it was like a Man-Thing situation. So I don't know. I'd like him to take on like something like Brother Power the Geek. He's done stuff at DC. He did Hard Time, which was about a there was a line of comic books that was launched. I can't remember what they were called. But it had it, one of them was Hard Time and Hard Time 2, and it was sort of about a superpowered young guy who went to an adult prison. Like he went to prison, and it was about him in prison. And he wrote that for DC. I actually think Steve Gerber, I would have liked to see him do something like Brother Power the Geek, because he's like a hippie ragdoll. I it would be very interesting to see him do a Brother Power the Geek. I think he would have been interesting to do like a Suicide Squad, because they are dysfunctional. Like, they don't even want to be there. And I think that would be awesome to see Steve Gerber on a Suicide Squad. And Swamp Thing, because he's like the man thing. Ambush Bug, because he tells you how it is. Yeah, I don't know. It's tough, but those are some ideas that I would like to see him tackle on the DC side. To him to do the Champions, because that was another dysfunctional team, I think, that would have been interesting to play with. It had Ghost Rider, Hercules, Black Widow, Iceman, and Angel. And the only two that really were together were Iceman and Angel. So, yeah, that'd be interesting. The Runaways could be interesting from, Marvel Comics, because they were formed based on their parents, and their parents were evil. That could have been cool. So those are some things maybe I'd like to see Steve Gerber tackle. Spawn, that would be interesting, I think. Another question, he says, what comic series creator or company needs a documentary? I'd love to have one on Secret Wars, because I heard enough stories about how pushy the editors got to include the event popular characters in different titles to boost sales. I'd love a documentary from beginning to end on Jim Shooter, to see how he started, as a young kid writing comics. And they're like, we want you to fly you out to DC, to New York to talk about, your writing gig on Legion of Superheroes. And he's like, well, I need a parent permission. They didn't even know he was a kid, I'd love to see, like, from the beginning of, Legion of Superheroes, all the way through his editorial gig at Marvel Comics, where he ruled by an iron hand, but he did a damn good job of it, because we got good product under his helm. And then his Valiant run, his Broadway, his Defiant. I would love to see like a documentary on Jim Shooter. I think Jack Kirby would be another one, because there's plenty of shit on, Stan Lee, but to see a documentary on Jack Kirby that is like a 2-hour documentary, I think it'd be fascinating. Steve Ditko is another one. I think that would be great. Man, there's so many of them that I'd like to see. There's just a ton. Jerry Conway, because I loved his writing. Jon Ostrander. Love to see like a documentary of Jon Ostrander in the back of Suicide Squad, focusing on like his whole run on Suicide Squad and his relationship with Kim Yale and them doing Manhunter. And that would be awesome. I've seen panels with Marv Wolfman and George Perez, but to see something like on them would be really neat. Any of the image creators that like I see a lot, but I'd like to see like where they do like a half hour with each image creator, and then we could see their sides of the story. Like, here's Rob Liefeld's side of the story. Here's Eric Larson's side. Here's Todd McFarlane. Here's Silvestri, and here is, Valentino and Todd McFarlane. There's plenty of image documentaries, but I would just like to see one where we get it all and everybody gets like equal time. Valentino, I think, would be is you know, they need to give him more screen time. I'd like to see that and more Eric Larson. Eric Larson would be a fabulous creator. Who wrote? I'd love to see a documentary on. I need to bring up my database because I Charles Forsman, who wrote The End of the Fucking World and all those weird books that went to Netflix, he seems like a massive depressive guy, but they've turned his works into like masterpieces on Netflix, I think. Even they're even better than comic books, but I'd like to get inside of his mind and see where he came from and why he does what he does. There's the man, there's a lot of underground stuff I'd like to see. That would be cool. Yeah, there's just tons of stuff that I would love to see, but especially the 90s stuff. I don't know. That's where I thought like I would love to see one on the Ultraverse. That would be so sweet. Paradise or just a Malibu comics in general or something about like the indie comics in the 90s, not including Image, like Triumphant and all these like things that launched that I bought, like Malibu, the Ultraverse, Broadway, Defiant, all that kind of stuff. I would just go gaga over. That's a good question. And I like it all. I don't like straight on interviews like that. I don't listen to interview shows that much. Like I, there's a rare, those are rare that I'll listen to one, and I don't know why I don't like them. But when it's like somebody doing like a documentary and on a theme, like Rob Liefeld's doing like the rivalries now, that is fun stuff to listen to. Like all comic book rivalries. And how the rivalries and competition bring out the best in creativity. I think that's amazing. So, yeah, that's. There's probably a lot of other ideas I can think of. Kirk Spencer asks, do you think we will ever see an era of experimentation like DC had in the 80s? I think we're going away from experimentation for a while, but I think you're referring to like where they sort of, you know, had a variety of material. And even in the New 52, I would say that was experimentation. They threw out a lot of titles like I, Vampire, Our Army at War, Men of War, Black Hawk, Jonah Hex, All Star Western. I mean, they threw a lot of stuff. It just that nobody was buying it. I think they've always done, like in every previews, you'll see. I think, like everybody worries that, oh, everything's focused on Batman, but. If you go through previews, there's always like one or two picks, and you're like, wow, how did this get published? Recently, like Inferior Five, which I thought was amazing. What an amazing piece of work. You know, how does that make it? And they got cut short, like by 6 issues, and then those 2 issues got coveted, and now they're coming out in trade. And if you wanted to finish the story, you had to read, 5 and 6 digitally. So yeah, you know, they experiment. The Great Ten. I mean, there's been all kinds of different books that they try, and they just don't take off. Now they're doing milestone characters again. But it's all about the dollars, like, and marketing. Like, how do they? What's going to be successful for them? Do they do a Batman cartoon or Batman figures the best selling? Who wants to see an animated cartoon? Who wants to see a live action movie of this? Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that they have to deal with, but if you go through previews, you'll always find like one or two things that are like, oh, this is cool, you know? I can't believe they published it and I'm going to support it. And a lot of other people don't support it. They don't care. But yeah, I've always thought there's been in the 70s they had that implosion. They experimented like hell. Joker had his own book, you had Sword and Sorcery, you had Warlord. You know, there was a lot of books being published. You had Tor, Stalker, you know. I think in every era, and then you had a lot of romance comics in the 60s and 70s, which I don't know if that'll ever come back, but I'd be on board for that. I really would, 'cause there's a lot you can do with those romance comics. So, yeah, thanks for the question, Nick and Kirk. I think I'm going to remove these now. That way I don't forget. And then wrap that up and leave me some questions for next time. But thanks for listening, and I will be back with Mike M's Weekly Reads. Take care, everybody. See you soon in a few minutes, as soon as I get all the numbers calculated. Welcome back to Mike M's Weekly Reads, where I'm going to be going over the weekly reads. But first, I wanted to just say I had gone to the comic shop and I asked him how he did during the free comic book day, and he said it was about 60% of the traffic he normally gets on free comic book day, which I guess was pretty good given the circumstances of the COVID Delta variant. So yeah, and I had heard Arkham City Comics Collectibles from the Bright Side chat say pretty much the same, about 60%. Curious to see how other shops did. You know, being that it was COVID flaring up again, and wondering what was going on. People trying to get those Something Is Killing the Children spin-offs from Boom and Red Room exclusives for free comic book day. There was quite a few exclusives. There was at least a handful of, you know, five or six to keep an eye on. Luckily, I buy so much from DCBS. I cleaned house with the free comic book day comics. So I was able to get all of them, even the strange ones. But yeah, just a quick mention. This past weekend, my parents were in town, but I didn't get to read a lot. But I did read The Crow, Leith, I guess that's how you pronounce it, Lethe, and I had read it number one a month or two ago, and I was like, this is weird. And I had just come off of reading Todd McFarlane's he didn't do The Crow, but his publishing company put out The Crow, and I had just finished reading that, and I got on a Crow kick, and I wanted to read more Crow, and I pulled out this IDW, and you know what? I didn't care for it. But now that I read the next two issues, it was awesome. Like, things started to click for me, and I started to understand who this new Crow was. And it was kind of odd because he was like part of this freak show, and it just the artist really clicked with me. They had Peach Momoko covers. I could take them or leave it. Like, sometimes Peach kicks some ass, and I get it, like her stylized with some of the templates. On the Crow, it looks pretty good. I mean, they'd make some nice t-shirts. Drinking some Mountain Dew Zero. Try to get a kick of caffeine to wake me up. Kind of tired. Long week. Last couple of weeks have been really long at work, and my reading count is plummeting, but hopefully with retirement coming soon, I can be able to read more. At least I hope so. I never know. I'll probably ride out till I can no longer ride the horse. But Mikey's tired, man. He's tired of working. I've been working since I was 14, continuously, nonstop, never a break. And just want to retire. I feel like I've done my time and I want to ride off into the sunset on a glory horse and just start enjoying things and relaxing. But you never know. I mean, things come up, plans change. I may work till I die. I don't know. You don't want that to happen, but you never know what will happen. So I'm going to talk about the weekly reads. I bundled 3 weeks in this bundle, and I may be losing my voice. I've been noticing that when I talk a while, that it starts to go. So bear with me. But we're going to talk about books from June 28th through July 4th, the 4th of July weekend. It was a decent week that week. I like to read in the 30s, 30 books. This was 28. Not successful in terms of percentage of books in and books read, but pretty successful being that I'm working full time and more than full time and able to get as much read as I can pretty much all on a Saturday. So just so you know, I don't often read comics during the week. I will read them sometimes when I can't sleep on the iPad. I'll pull up Marvel Unlimited or DC Infinite app, and I'll read some off of there. But normally, I don't read during the week, and then Saturday is like decompression day, and I usually get up early. I sit on my favorite spot on the couch. I grab a handful of books, sometimes driven by podcasts. So when it's Geek Brunch, it's pretty much Geek Brunch and DC Spotlight. They're pre-chosen books, so it's almost like you read what I have for that week. If it's Geek Brunch Retro, I have a little more flexibility in terms of mood. I can go into whatever I feel like it. Same thing with DC everything else, except it has to be DC or DC derived or DC purchased. So it could still be like something like Charlton or, like it could break the rules there. And I don't feel guilty about doing it. But, Geek Brunch is kind of free form, but me and Bill agree to, like a bunch of number ones usually, or a trade paperback that he got and he wants to read. He usually drives the ship and he usually reads ahead of time and then tells me, Mike, why don't we cover this? But lately I've been driving the ship and I've had some success, and but the thing that Bill does differently is he reads ahead. And then he chooses what he likes the best, whereas I just randomly pick on something that I either want to read or something that I've neglected for a long time that I want to see what's happening, and then I pick it. And that's usually what this week here I can tell was a Geek Brunch week, and I'll tell you why. We had 28 comics. We had a pretty good distribution. 13 Marvel. Again, I've been reading a lot. that week I read a lot on the iPad for whatever reason. I think I was we did something on July 4th, I can't remember. But I read a lot of the X-Men related books on Marvel Unlimited. I've been getting my money's worth on the digital apps, to tell you the truth. DC Spotlight, usually read whatever gets picked on the poll. We usually have a poll and we cover that, and that's always a lot of fun. I pick two choices and then Kyle picks two choices. We put it on the poll. We usually get 30 to 50. I'm really happy when we get like 50 entries. We've had a lot of ties, so we've had a lot of flips. This past week was close, but Superman came out on tap. John Byrne's Superman, which I was really happy to revisit. But we had 13 Marvel, 3 Kickstarters. I've been trying to read at least one Kickstarter a week as a goal. 2 Image, 3 Boom, 1 Avatar, 3 Aftershock, 3 Ablaze. So a lot of A's. The things that we watched that week, this was before I started to not like Loki, but I gave Loki a 4 out of 5, whatever episode that turned out to be. Watched the 5 out of 5 I gave to on HBO Max, Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It. I really this movie really clicked with me. I on so many levels. And then when Barb started to do fact checking on what was true and what wasn't, that even made my interest just blow up even more on that horror movie. And then another horror movie was The Forever Purge. I don't know why it is, but I really like these purges. It's like Ra's al Ghul or Vandal Savage, who are known for, or Thanos. Even Thanos is known for this. They're known for like getting rid of the weak, and they want to reduce the population on Earth. And, Thanos is, worried about overpopulation and infinity and stuff like that. And so is Ra's, and get rid of the weak and let the strong prosper, as well as Vandal Savage. These guys live forever, it seems like. And the Forever Purge is kind of like if they were running the country, in the United States. They decide they're one day a year. They allow all kinds of crime for 24 hours. That's Barb, so I'm gonna have to pause here. I'm back, and I think I was talking about the purge. So the purge is they decide we're gonna let all the rules go, and if you're well to do, not too bad of a j thing, you can lock yourself in your home and protect yourself and arm yourself and make it through the night. It's usually the poor that have to deal with this chaos. And in this Forever Purge, it deals with some Hispanics that work on a ranch. And yeah, they're sort of they are there's people that are prejudiced against them, of course. And in this Forever Purge, it's real racial. Like it seems like it was related to the Trump registry, kind of thing, where he was putting up the wall between Mexico and the United States, and there was a lot of white supremacy type things going on. And in this Forever Purge, they decided. A lot of these white guys decided, fuck it. Instead of the 24 hours kicking off, let's just take over, kind of thing, And it was sort of these two guys and another family that they worked for on the ranch, who they became friends with, even though they weren't friends before, trying to get over to Mexico and get into their borders because the United States was in chaos. And it makes me want to watch the. There was a series called The Purge, and I think it's showing on Hulu. Barb and I are watching the next season of The Movies That Made Us on Netflix. Just watched the Back to the Future, so that's one of the things. We're also catching up on Riverdale, believe it or not. And I don't know if this is the final season, but it's really an interesting one because a lot of the Riverdales had similar themes with serial killers and stuff like that. We're kind of leading to a dark area, but the thing that's interesting is this takes place like 8 years after their graduation, so they're coming back from college or the army or various different things. So we've been catching up on Riverdale. So I think the Purge is gonna be in queue. But what was I talking about? Oh, the movies that we watched on there. So yeah. Now I can get into the comics. I gave a 2 out of 5. I was pretty harsh on it, which means I didn't like it. I can't be totally say I didn't like it. There are aspects of this that I like. It just seems as its own entity. It's directionless. It just feels like a tie-in book tied into all the stuff that's happening on Krakoa and the X-Men, and also to the Venom event, and it doesn't know its own identity. So that's my main complaint with the book. They do have some interesting things. I've always liked Abigail Brand, and she hosts Magneto in the launch of the new program, the space program that she has. She forms a team to help combat the darkness that Null is bringing. Abigail sends Manifold over to Krakoa, where he battles Null. Mentallo, he's my favorite character in this series, but he's a very money hungry and humorous type character, and he makes for very interesting storytelling and something you can get away with. This is by Al Ewing, and I have to be honest with you, Al has he's rocked my world with things like Immortal Hulk and some things. But in this Sword, he's not really rocking my world, but he's sort of scratching that itch where he could get away with murder with certain characters, and having this Mentallo on the team makes it pretty damn interesting for me. You might ask, is this an X-Men book or a tie-in with, what's going on with Null? I haven't figured it out on why it exists or why they chose to exist, and I don't think Al Ewing has established the book as its own book, but I'm sticking around. I am. We then got into Uncanny X-Men 245, and believe it or not, I was missing this issue, and for those who've been listening to the show, I am a huge 90s buff, and it bugs me that people make fun of the 90s, but I'm a Bronze Age kid. I grew up in the Bronze Age in the 70s. I read a lot of comics, and up until this point, at that point, 70s and 80s, I love those comics. I still love those comics, but there was something like explosive in the 90s that happened, and I felt like things changed. I felt like, Superman died. I felt like Batman got his back broke. I felt like Kyle Rayner was coming on to his own, and Wally was kicking ass as usual. I felt that Image was blowing up, and it was exciting. It was a different type of storytelling. It was a lot of splash art pages and a lot of action, and action before story. I like the change, and I like that I could get that action and Image and then cross the street over to Valiant, which seemed more less artsy and more story driven, with Jim Shooter driving the train, and Jim Shooter leaving and then going off to Defiant, and then Defiant becoming Broadway and Triumphant Comics and the sci-fi world, and techno comics and Ultraverse, and everything was just exploding. The Protectors and Malibu. I was just so excited for all of this. And this was a comic book before Rob, blew up. The cover was inked by McFarlane. And so you had Liefeld on pencils, inked by McFarlane. But it was sort of Chris Claremont doing a done-in-one story of an alien invasion as a comedy. And, Rob Liefeld was doing the pencils on this alien invasion. And did he draw some killer eyebrows on Wolverine? And sometimes you couldn't even see his eyes. And I don't know if that was Rob or if that was, they look like Eugene Levy eyebrows. I mean, you know what I'm talking about if you know Eugene Levy from Second City TV or Schitt's Creek. Yeah, it was fun. I gave it a 3 out of 5. Wasn't as big as I thought it would be, but it was nice to see Rob on pencils. And there was stuff like I would like to know about this because I don't know if it was the inker or what, but it didn't look like Rob's art when he was drawing the background. Because in some of this alien stuff where they were, getting ready to attack Earth, there was a lot of panels that had like all kinds of alien creatures. Like you see like Yoda and you'd see like Darth Vader. You'd see like the alien from Aliens. You'd see a Predator. And I don't know if it was Rob throwing that in or if it was the inker. It was really hard to tell. And I think it was the inker. But it would be an interesting question. From Ablaze, we have Eros and Psyche. Bill's liking this one a lot more than me, but it's like a psychological thriller in an all-girls school. But not a lot happens in each issue. It's beautifully drawn. So there is that. I still don't know what the hell is going on at the school, but Sarah and Silgi appear to be the only two students left from that original crew. There's still students in the background, and they seem to have like a lesbian relationship of some sort, but it's hard to tell if there's something else going on. I'm always curious what the reveal will bring, and Lovett's art is as beautiful as ever. She's amazing. Uncanny X-Men minus one. So this was also an issue I was missing, and I picked up. I think I covered these on retro. So this was a retro week, believe it or not. It doesn't seem like a retro week, but I can tell that it was based on those two books. Rachel Summers and Trask's daughter, Sanctity, make a trip to the past to stop Master Mold. And I didn't know that Trask had a daughter called Sanctity. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here that was interesting, but I hadn't read some of this stuff, so this was hitting me. Like, I knew who Master Mold was, I know who Rachel Summers is. I know who Trask is, but I was like, I never heard of Sanctity. So, yeah, it was an interesting. These minus one issues are kind of interesting from Marvel Comics, and some of them are better than others. But that was the last 3 out of 5. So the 3 out of 5s were X-Men 245, Eros and Psyche 3 and 4, Uncanny X-Men. And then we had X-Factor 6 and 8. Where the team is investigating, this is the 4 out of 5. The many deaths of Siren. It turns out Siren's body is manifest by another mutant, and it almost leads to the death of Dokken. Now that the team is knows what's going on, they can stop Morrigan, who's the goddess of death, and that's the goddess that's taken over Siren's body. This is an interesting arc, but it's lasting forever. Like I'm like, okay, let's get on, let's step on the gas a little bit, man. Come on. Ant number 12. This was Eric Larson coming back to Ant. A lot of interesting experiments, I think, with the colors and the line work. Really enjoyed it. It sort of wrapped up the original series, but it's so long ago, I don't remember a lot of it. The road to getting here makes for some interesting back matter, and Eric really believed in this character, and in some cases, seems to have cared about the character more than Mario Gully did, which is fascinating. And it seems like Mario created this character, and I think he was in prison when he created it, but he got out and put this out, and it was sort of a underground success at Arkea, and then it went to Image, and then Eric was like, "Come on, you gotta finish this." He was trying to motivate him, and I think he lost interest in the book and then wanted to sell it. And I think he was like co-writing it with a Kaufman guy who eventually became the owner of Big City Comics. And then Ant moved over to Big City Comics from Image. And it seems like he was looking to sell it, maybe to Kaufman, maybe, But Eric came in and got it for, offered more, I guess. But I don't know why he had this cool property and wanted to sort of get rid of that property. Because I think that Gully is talented. And if you're a McFarlane fan, like you can see in his character, and especially when she's out of costume, she kind of looks like Wanda from Spawn. And he's got like a Todd McFarlane influence. That Mario Gully. But I'm glad it's in good hands with Eric Larson, my love of the 90s. So those guys are, when Todd McFarlane left Spider-Man, I was like, oh man, what's gonna happen? And it took me a few issues to adjust to the line work of Eric Larson, but then I think Eric Larson like exceeded Todd's pencils on Spider-Man and in a different way. The panels seemed more dynamic. They seemed more action, like there was more movement. He seemed to have I don't know, it just seemed like a lighter tone, which Spider-Man had always been. And when McFarlane came off of Amazing, he was sort of a Michelinie script, and then he darkened it with Spider-Man. But anyway, this is Ant. What am I doing? See, I'm going off in tangent. So after reading this, I did an audit of Ant, and I found out I was missing Ant number 2 from Arkea, and I purchased it. I had to fix it and placed an order, even though it was $45. I wanted to make sure I had it. Ant in this comic is being chased by an organization that wants her costume. She is later saved by her father. And you learn some of her backstory, which is good because I had forgotten a lot of it. You got to remember that this came out almost a decade earlier, if not more. I then jumped into Masters of the Universe for Retrocast. I didn't end up covering it. I ended up covering X-Men 245 and G.I. Joe. But I started watching the Masters of the Universe on Netflix, the Kevin Smith, and I have I'm gonna let me tell you where I'm coming from on Masters of the Universe. I didn't give a crap about them. Like, I sort of bought them all from DC, and I do own like their first appearance in DC Comics Presents, but never really cared about the property. I never bought the toys. I bought them because they were DC and I have to have everything DC. But I never went to like the Image or the CrossGen imprint that printed them. And then I started to want them. Like I and then the cartoon even got me more excited. I don't like the original cartoon, but like this cartoon is very dark in tone and I think more mature, and I really like the plot. Like I really am driven by the plot of this. So I pulled out, Masters of the Universe from 2002. Skeletor is complaining that the crystals are no longer working, while Evil Lyn is like, I know how the crystals work. Why are you such a stupid? Meanwhile, in Eternia, Master of Arms and He-Man spot a fire and try to put it out, but Orko puts it out again with magic because he ran across those crystals. This leads to Man-at-Arms and He-Man to head to Castle Grayskull. Orko's magic is pretty fucked up. He usually fucks up. He's like the comic relief in the Masters of the Universe, Cringer and Orko, and Orko's kind of annoying to me, at least initially. But I will say, in the new Kevin Smith, like, Orko is very built out. Like, I think they justified why Orko exists. They you learn his origin, you learn his worth, you learn his sacrifice, and I really liked Orko in the cartoon on Netflix. There were only 5 episodes, so I think the next 5 will probably be coming out soon. I hope in this fiscal year anyway. But we have Coven, the Dark Sister. This was an issue I was missing. I had just recently read a lot of the Image Coven, Awesome Comics, Coven. I had started reading the Avatar, and I had skipped out on all the Avatar stuff, and I've been trying to slowly pick up the Avatars that came out around this time. It was interesting time for sure, because Rob Liefeld was leasing out like glory to Alan Grant and Avatar, and Alan Grant, Alan Moore, and you had Coven there, even though it wasn't Ian Churchill and Jeff Loeb. It still was damn interesting, and the art was ooh. The one thing that Avatar has always had going for it is like badass artists. They have great writers too at certain titles, like Warren Ellis and Alan Moore and Christos Gage and Garth Ennis. So like Avatar had some powerful stuff. But this coven, Eden wreaks havoc on her sister Spellcaster, who's a member of the coven. She brings back parts of history to destroy the city, and is trying to bring back Spellcaster's mom so she can kill her again. So she doesn't want to bring back her mom to celebrate or anything. She hates her so much. She wants to be the one responsible for her second death. So Spellcaster and her have a discussion during the fight, and Eden vanishes. Phantom and Scratch. Phantom's kind of the vampire, and Scratch is sort of like the werewolf, I guess, of the coven. And Spellcaster's the witch, obviously. Did not have time to really assist in the fight. And then there's another character. I can't remember his name, but he looks more like a golem, the Jewish character that is made of clay. But that was Coven, a 4 out of 5. And then I had H.P. Lovecraft's Beauty and the Beast. This was a Kickstarter. I just saw a couple of pages of art, and it looked interesting. I had no fucking idea what it was about. And it took me a little bit to get into it, but once I was in the flow, I had to log on to see if they had any more. But to Kickstarter. But a student goes to college to become an anthropologist and meets a professor that sees her talents because she can understand the hieroglyphics. The department is struggling financially, and they had to get an alumni called the Beast, and I put that in quotes because that's not really not his name, to finance the department. Only if Amorphia comes to help him and spawn with him. You don't know that originally, but he wants to breed with her. And this guy, all she knows is that this guy's rich. He has a mansion. He's going to be funding the department. And she goes there, and he's a monster that wants to breed with her. But his mansion is very disturbing and horrific, and it's beautifully drawn. I really like this series. It's 4 out of 5. X-Men 1 and 2. This was me rereading the Marvel X-Men, where Hickman took over. The X-Men take down the last Orchis strongholds on Earth. Later, Scott and his entire family celebrate on the moon. Meanwhile, the members of Orchis, I don't even know if I pronounced that right, are regrouping, and we found out that Dr. Gregor is trying to bring back her husband because the X-Men killed him. Scott, Nate, and Rachel go on a mission together to find out why Krakoa is moving toward another strange island populated by monsters and the summoner of Arako. The summoner does have something to do with the apocalypse. With Apocalypse, actually, the X-Men Apocalypse. But what that's leading to is X of Swords, really. We got Berserker number 2 and 3 from Boom. This was the last 4 out of 5. This series has been rocking my world. I am digging this. It's nothing that hasn't been done before, and but it's really well done to me. Ron Gardney on art, classy, awesome. Matt Kent helping Keanu on script. But it's about an immortal. So we learn the origin story of Berserker. He was born of two parents that got tired of having their village raided, so they prayed to the gods for a weapon. That weapon turned out to be their son and their savior. His father teaches him to slaughter other tribes next to their valley. They call him Yunut, which is weapon and tool. They prayed for protection, but now they are evil. We learn that his father was not really his father, but that there was a lightning god that was. I don't know what I meant there. We are that in issue 2. I don't know why we learn that probably in issue 2. I don't know why I said ah. But the scientist is trying to figure out in current time more about Berserker. We jump into the 5 out of 5s. There's quite a few. The Many Deaths of Lila Starr number 2. This one I didn't think I was gonna like as much as I did, but I really like religion, and I really like that the goddess of death is worried about a child that's being born that is gonna prolong life, and the lead god says, "Well, if this happens, we no longer need you to be death because death will be obsolete." So I'm sending you down to be a human and many deaths. That's Lila Starr. But Darius is a kid that is going to make everyone immortal. He is raised by his family, and they are well-to-do, and they have servants while he's growing up. Darius bonds to one of the workers, and when they move away, they are told that the servant dies, and that servant meant a lot to Darius. Lila witnesses the funeral and ends up dying a third time. We have the Death Tally. This was a Kickstarter, number 1. This was awesome. I really love this. The art in it, impeccable. The story was really good. But the scene opens up with Death killing a man with her boyfriend. Later, a couple that wants to get married, Ahiva and Jace, go to visit Ahiva's father, a conspiracy theorist who is tracking strange deaths. A few days later, the father is in a car accident, and Ahiva is devastated. She gets mad at Jace at the gravesite and throws a watch made from meteor rock at Jace and hits Death. So Death is there. Later, they are both transported to a strange world and introduced to Adelburn and the Council, and they say she is going to be the new Reaper. So we have the next one, Join the Future 3 and 5. This is from Aftershock. I gave the first two a 5 out of 5, and I finally finished it, This series is awesome. Aftershock has been, when I'm getting into it, they've been a 4 out of 5 or 5 out of 5. Really consistent. Clementine is trained by the traitor in exchange for cooking. Clementine was the one that lost her father. She had asthma, and she lived on the outskirts of a sanctuary in the future, and that sanctuary wants to expand, and they don't want these little small towns to exist. They want to consume them into the future. The first time she seeks revenge turns into a nightmare, and she is captured and going to be killed until Traitor saves her. She then sets her town on fire in hopes of stopping the large machines. The owner of the city sends the sheriff and his technical posse to kill her, but when the machines get close, they disrupt their guns and she kills them. She then has a showdown with the sheriff and wins. The city guy gets away, and Traitor gets killed when saving Clementine one more time. Will there be a sequel when she goes into the Techno City? Yes, there is. Because it's already out. The next 5 out of 5 is I haven't rated Gung Ho less than a 5 out of 5, but it's the third volume. It's called Gung Ho Anger. Zack and the kids find the brother at the outpost. They bring him food and they learn about the orphanage. Back at the safe zone, the parents are wondering where the heck the kids are. But this is an amazing post-apocalyptic story about teenagers growing up in these outposts. And one of the brothers is banned for raping a girl he didn't rape. He was actually trying to protect her from a guy, a man that was raping her, but she blamed him because the guy was giving her drugs and she's a drug addict, so she's not going to go against the rape because she would stop getting her supply of drugs. And he's banished. And the thing is, when you're not in an outpost, there's these white, they look like ape wolves. They're probably the size of a mountain lion, a big mountain lion, but they're in packs and they like slaughter humans, and they're pretty smart and intelligent. But really enjoying Gung Ho. That's from Ablaze Comics. The last 5 out of 5 is G.I. Joe, a real American hero. 137 and 138. I am loving this. I gotta get back into it. I've taken a couple weeks off, but I can't find these issues, and I bought a couple of trades to keep me occupied until I can find the issues. And this one, Cobra Commander takes over Destro's castle and is trying to hunt down Destro and Baroness and kill them. Scarlet is working deep undercover with Cobra. Hawk and Stalker know that she's working undercover, and she is sent to kill them. And then she believes she did kill them. As Destro is working with the Joes, Snake Eyes and Storm Shadow go to rescue. And Snake Eyes has to drive a sword in Scarlet's heart, which just misses it. But you like know that he missed on purpose. Like he wanted to keep her alive, and he doesn't know though. Only Stalker and Hawk know that she's undercover. As far as Storm Shadow and Snake Eyes know, she betrayed him. But I think he has like extra senses, and he can detect, like her heartbeat and stuff, so he knows he kept her alive. A Decepticon shows up in the last panel, so it will be a crossing over Transformers. And the second issue was polybagged with the card, although the card was like, it wasn't even a cool character, it was like a building, but it's still interesting. So let's jump into, July 5th through July 11th. We start at the bottom. There's 24 comics. One Storm King, one Marvel, 8 damage, 12 DC, 2 black mask. The TV and movies, there were 5 out of 5s that week. I watched Black Widow, the movie. I really enjoyed it. It's got to be in my top 5 Marvel movies. And I thought it being a prequel, and you already know the outcome, that the magic wouldn't be there. Well, I felt the magic was there. And I really liked the family dynamic. It's such a dysfunctional family. And those that have been listening to this podcast know that I'm a sucker for dysfunctional teams. And this really worked for me. And then Evil, which is on Paramount. I haven't watched Paramount in a while, so that's one service I'm paying for. But I was able to watch Evil on it. We did watch Clarice on there too. But Evil, Bill Bomer told me about it on when it came to Netflix, and it was a CBS show, and I guess Evil went straight to Paramount instead of CBS, but the second season's been pretty damn amazing. 5 out of 5. Highly recommended. If you're a horror fan, you really need to watch Evil. I mean it. I don't. There's not a lot of things that freak me out, but Evil always has an episode or two that freak my shit. Yep, freaks my shit. So there's 3 out of 5. We get into the comics. We got Tales of Science Fiction Hell. A corporation puts together a team, one lizard boy, a criminal, and the other members take a trip to Middle Earth, otherwise known as Hell. I forget what they're looking for, though. They're going there for a reason. But I think that lizard boy is actually from there. So we'll see how that pans out. Bill picked that for Geek Brunch, and that one, I liked it, but it didn't rock my world. There's a couple of other Storm King books from John Carpenter's company that I like a lot more than this one coming up in this list or next week's list. But we get in the 4 out of 5s. We have Time Before Time. Crime syndicate has time pods where they hide criminals and people that need protection in time. They also use pods to get materials from the past and the future. Two of the guys want out and steal a pod, and one of them has to go on a mission and dies in the future in prison. So, interesting stuff there. We have X-Men number 3. This is the Jonathan Hickman X-Men. Horticulture. This was a weird book because horticulture is a bunch of old women, and we're talking about 80s and 90s women scientists. They evade Krakoa, and they have their way with the X-Men, essentially. These old ladies. It was almost kind of humorous and weird. It didn't feel like a Hickmanism. I don't know. I've read Hickman, at least all his Marvel stuff, and I've read most of his Image stuff, but I never read News. What was it called? Something News. But I think I have it somewhere in the closet that's uninventoried. But I like Hickman, but he's not my favorite. He's very grandiose, or I don't know how you say that word, but big picture thinking, kind of like Grant Morrison, except he's grounded. In other words, you can understand him. And Morrison sometimes goes off on an acid trip, and you don't know what the hell he's doing. At least that's how I interpret him. We have Red Tornado 1 through 4. John Smith is a hero and has a girlfriend and an orphan friend that sort of makes them a family until they run into the Construct. The Construct is freed in the Justice League headquarters, and he plots to turn the world against Red Tornado. Red Tornado is convinced He can't help humanity and sort of just goes down into shutdown mode. Construct is taking over control of all machines and humans. He leaves Red Tornado's girlfriend free, and she manages to save the world by convincing the Red Tornado to help again. Bad mistake on Construct's part. That was weird. He almost wanted to torture Red Tornado's friend and lover for no reason. Like something that a computer would not do. Like it doesn't seem logical that you would keep her alive unless you wanted to torture Red Tornado, John Smith. But as far as goals, the construct accomplished it. Like he got Red Tornado to shut down, and he got the whole Justice League to turn against him. But this was the winner of the DC Spotlight. I encourage you guys to go listen to DC Spotlight with me and Kyle. We have a lot of fun and discussion about these books. That was Red Tornado 1 through 4, his first mini. We have Robin 1 through 3, also something we discussed on DC Spotlight, where Robin wins a fight with Kingsnake and is invited to a Fight Club Island. He is killed by Flatline in the first issue, and you realize you get 3 lives on the island, which is never explained, and it's just fucking weird. It's almost like he's on a video game survival island, and you can lose 2 lives, but your third, you're dead. And Ravager is kind of his mentor on this island, along with Ghost Alfred. He runs into Connor Hawke, the League of Shadows, and he's sort of, I think, representing the League of Assassins. And I think he gets killed a second time outside the tournament time, so we don't know if that counts because Connor drops him off of a cliff and kills him a second time. So I don't know if he's down to nothing. But then we have from DC Comics, Crime Syndicate 1 through 4. This was also covered on DC Spotlight, where we really break it down. But the origin stories of Power Ring, the Owl, Ultraman, and Superwoman. This does feel a little different than previous incarnations. It also shows the Meta Criminals and Luther joining to stop Starro, the Conqueror. If you've seen the movie The Suicide Squad, then Luther recruits Power Ring with the Sinestro and Lonar. And you're like, well, Lonar? What the fuck is that? Well, you guys that have read the Jack Kirby's Fourth World, yeah, that's that Lunar with the same horse. Superwoman and the Owl recruit Ultraman. So we have Spawn 318 and 319. Spawn questions medieval Spawn's loyalties when back at headquarters. They go look for Mark, and when he appears, the medieval Spawn armor is on the floor. Jessica and Mark try to figure out what is going on with the earthquakes. Spawn is ready to go back into battle. An Italian chef is well loved, but has a hidden wine cellar to torture individuals. And he is a vampire. Spawn is unleashed on him. And I think with Spawn 319, if I remember correctly, if you've been reading Spawn, the cover price is still $2.99. And you'll notice the cover stock changed and the price didn't. It went to a thick cover stock with 319. We got Spawn Universe number one. This is a one shot that's leading into the other Spawn titles, King Spawn, Gunslinger Spawn, and that other one, which I can never remember. But Spawn and Saigor go back to the island, only to be captured by the Disruptor. He takes control of Saigor and imprisons Cog. Spawn and Gunslinger Spawn. Da da da. Oh, he imprisons Cog, Spawn, and Gunslinger Spawn. Cog escapes, and Cog is really Cogliostro. I can never pronounce it, but I'll call him Cog. He's that old fucker with a beard that's been in Spawn since the dawn of time. But Cog escapes and is dropped into the darkness by his captors. Spawn and Gunslinger make an escape, a ship, and all the members get killed as Cog becomes reincarnated as a new character called Sin, and that's spelled Sinn, and it's his first appearance as Sin. Jessica visits her daughter, who thinks she is the aunt, one last time. So she visits her daughter. It's really her daughter, but she acts like it's her aunt because her daughter's being taken care of by her mom. Jessica is she Spawn, for those of you that are not into Spawn. So, Mark has nightmares of medieval Spawn losing all of his men and fighting a dragon, and then gunslinger Spawn in the West comes back to life in the past as his whole posse was slaughtered. And then we have Savage Dragon 259, the introduction of North Force as they're trying to recruit Malcolm. Aliens invade and North Force goes to stop them. Captain Tootsie, those of you who have been reading comics since the 50s might know who Captain Tootsie is. He's one of those public domain characters. But Captain Tootsie stops them and suggests they have to go into space to proactively stop the aliens. Malcolm can't leave his family, so the Canadian of North Force says they can't have him on the team because we don't got time for you if you can't leave your family and go out on this mission. And Savage Dragon 259 is also published as North Force Number Zero. So we get to the five out of fives. This one came and slapped me in the face and said, "Mike, you didn't expect this to be that good." And that's damn right. That's from Black Mask, and the book is called Alice in Leatherland. Alice writes children's books, and her friend that works with her is moving to San Francisco to work for another publisher. She asks Alice to go along, but Alice is committed to her relationship. Alice goes home and finds her girlfriend in bed with another woman after a softball game. She decides she's really depressed. She decides to leave. Not only does she catch her in bed with the other woman, but she catches her girlfriend talking about her in bed and what a loser she is and that she really doesn't want to be with her. So to make matters worse, so she's devastated and she doesn't know what she's going to do. So she decides to go with her friend to San Francisco. But she's too proud to ask her friend for a place to stay. Her friend offers her a place to stay, but she decides to leave Yellowstone for San Francisco and get a place of her own to rent. And you know, if you've ever watched the news or you ever have friends that live in San Francisco, that rent in San Francisco is impossible unless you're really rich. And a lot of people that are not really rich, they have to live with other people. So she has to get a house with two other roommates, and they're in the sex business. So it makes it really, they do sexual things for a living. Alice goes to Gay Pride on the second issue parade, where she sees her friend with a bunch of other women in open relationships. Like she'd be kissing two other women. So she gets depressed because she's like, "I have this friend who's kind of slutting around, and I didn't know this about her." Like she thought maybe something could happen magically between her and her friend, but she's with other women. She goes back to her new apartment, becomes friends with her new sex roommates, and one of her friends that she's with says, "I'll get you a job. You need a job, I'll get you a job so you can write your book on the side," because she's an author. And she gets her job at a sex shop. Oh, goodness. But the next five out of five is no surprise because it made a lot of five out of fives for a lot of people. It's from DC Black Label. It's called A Nice House on the Lake by James Tynion IV. Tynan, let's say James Tynan. A bunch of friends are invited to a beautiful lake house by a friend or a host they all knew for 1 week. And outside of the lake house is the end of the world. And they find out about it when they're at the house. So they're not part of this, like, they're protected by this alien that they think is their friend. We have Karma number three. This has been nothing short of miraculous, this series. But this is from Image Comics. Karma meets a man, Enrique, who's going to give an engagement ring to his girlfriend when he is hit by a car. Karma lets Kat know how selfish she was, taking her own life. Kat's the one that killed herself in issue one and kind of like floating around naked before she goes to heaven or hell. Like, karma is leading her into either purgatory or heaven or hell. And there is another karma. Well, I'll say karma, but there's these beings with these suits that takes Enrique to light to be reincarnated. So that's what their goal is they're supposed to take these dead bodies. And Kat doesn't want to go. She doesn't want to, like, pass on, you know. She'll get reincarnated, and Karma seems like she wants to ethically teach Kat a lesson before she's reincarnated. So if she does get reincarnated, she'll come back as a happier or more knowledgeable person for that matter, because she took her own life. We have this is this another surprise series that I didn't expect to. This is my favorite ongoing title. We talked about Gung Ho, but this Gung Ho is a bunch of mini series, but this is an ongoing title that just knocks my socks off, and it's called Radiant Black. Nathan and Marshall go to work on Nathan's powers by testing them. Later, they go to a movie when attacked by Radiant Red. He tries to save everyone in the building but ends up dying. So the major character in issues 1 through 3 is now dead. Now it looks like Marshall is going to be Radiant Black. The entity that talks to them when they are asleep has them prepping for a war to protect all of Earth. Too Funny Marshall Schools of Business. Those are like short stories at the end of, like, Marshall works at a video store, and they're kind of like short cartoons about them. A movie dating app and a newspaper proof of life story. Rescue crews able to bring back Nate. So Nate died in that issue, but they're able to bring him back, but now he's brain dead. So the main character of Radiant Black, the writer, is now dead, well, brain dead in a coma. Marshall is now Radiant Black and goes after Radiant Red, and they fight, and they are disrupted by more color radiance, stating that they are being hunted by a powerful being. So that was an incredible week. And then we get into the final week. Let's do July 12th through July 18th. And we'll start at the bottom. Only a total of 13 comics. We have three Storm King. We have four Marvel, one Kickstarter, three Image, one Dynamite, one DC. As far as TV and movies go, I gave a 2 out of 5 to the Loki finale. It just didn't work for me. But some of you know that I've always complained about, like, time-oriented series. I mean, sometimes I love them. We just talked about Time Before Time, but sometimes they just don't click with me. Like, a DC comic that did click with me about time was Kronos. I think that came out in the late 90s. That one really worked for me. And then Hour Man, most of you know the Hour Man from the JSA, but later on, Grant Morrison introduced a futuristic Hour Man from Justice League 1 Million, and that Hour Man got his own series. He's sort of like an android, But I enjoyed that, and that was very time related. Instead of being the miracle, the 1 hour pill that our man takes. The 3 out of 5 was the comebacks. This was about a loser coach that is told to coach a football team, and he's never won anything in his life. And it's really his friend who he grew up with, I think played by, was it Carl Weathers? But anyway, it was interesting. It was one of those movies that I was bagging and boarding comics, and I was like, I'll just put this on in the background. And it consumed me bagging and boarding the comics because I got into it. Even though I gave it a 3 out of 5, it wasn't like it blew my mind. The 4 out of 5s were phobias. This was a Hulu horror type anthology that dealt with a bunch of phobias, and all those phobias are tied to different people, and they all link into a psychiatric ward where there's an abusive doctor, with these people with different phobias. We have Employee of the Month. That was another one where I was bagging and boarding comics, and then I was like, you know what? I'm gonna record this and watch it later, and I really enjoyed it. It's like a Sam's Club. Where this guy is an awesome cashier and worker, and he gets employees of the month all the time. And then a beautiful girl, played by Jessica Simpson, comes into work there, and he gets motive the loser guy gets motivated to try to become employee of the month. We have Space Jam 2. I gave a 4 out of 5. Although I will say, I think a lot of the best scenes, at least for the characters that I care about, are in the preview. So I love Wile E. Coyote, who I think did a fantastic job. And then Yosemite Sam is another one I absolutely adore. Daffy Duck I like, but he didn't really play a big part. But it had some of my favorites in there, like Foghorn Leghorn, and I tend to like the characters that. Like Yosemite Sam's my favorite because the more pissed off he gets, the more trouble he gets into. I'd like to know who your favorite Looney Tune character is. Mine has got to be Yosemite with Coyote following a quick second there. And then the last 4 out of 5 was Star Wars Clone Wars Season 5. I'm already through Season 6 and on to Season 7. In Season 7, is the final season that leads into Bad Batch, and the first episode of season 7, which I did watch, is a Bad Batch episode that introduced Bad Batch, which became the Star Wars series. And after that episode, I just decided I needed a break. I had watched 2.5 seasons, starting in season 4 of Clone Wars, and I just needed to switch it up a bit. So I'm going to take about a month or two off before jumping back in and completing the Clone Wars saga. And then the last 5 out of 5 was Evil. It's already on hiatus until I think late August or September. But yeah, me and Barb love that show. A great show to watch together. We then get in the comics 3 out of 5. We have Tales of Science Fiction number 2. We learn more about the teenage subterranean boy and the detectives as the team heads to the Bermuda Triangle and are confronted by another ship as they try to make their way to Center Earth, which is hell. We get a 3 out of 5 on Batman Fortnite number 6. I think this was the finale. Lex Luthor and Deathstroke are back in our world and are trying to open a portal to Fortnite to raise hell in the DC universe. Batman and Catwoman use Harley to get back to Gotham. And that's how they leave it, is like the bad guys are trying to open up the portal to bring these crazy killers of Fortnite into Gotham City. We then have Dynamite Lives number 1. Ash is attacked at SMART, and Panther, Daredevil, Vampirella, and Miss Fury regroup to get ready to fight back after the first series. We then get into a Storm King, which I liked more than Hell, which was Night Terrors, the Black Sparrow. I think this was Steve Niles. A man loses his son to a hanging. His son is evil, but the family does not know. He is hanged, but then comes back to kill all kinds of people. The father and Native American try to hunt the demon down. The mother is having an affair with the sheriff, and they are killed trying to escape the town after she killed a crazy priest. The daughter gets away, and you think the evil might be with her as well. We then have Youngblood X-Force. X-Force Youngblood. I just gave credit to this as an Image book because they're sort of done by Liefeld's teams. So these ones were happening around the time that Rob was getting ready to leave. And I think in Rob's observations, he even meant that when he was getting ready to leave, the Image creators were holding back his paychecks for this book, at least one of these books. One was published by Marvel, one was published by Image. But anyway, both teams are teleported into Mojoverse with Mojo and Mojo 2. I didn't even know there was a Mojo 2. The second issue had a bunch of different artists, but one of them was Steven Platt. The art in the second issue I thought was better. Even though the first issue was more consistent. X-Force was ported back to Mojo World and not home at the end of the first one. We are led to believe that Dazzler and Longshot are dead. Youngblood feels they have to help Mojo World and manage to go back where the two teams work to fight the Four and Mojo. The teams succeed and find out that Dazzler and Longshot are alive, but Mojo gets away again. We have X-Men number 4. This is the Jonathan Hickman X-Men. Charles, Magneto, and Apocalypse meet for a summit with humanity and set the rules going forward as the humans try to attack, but Cyclops and Gorgon fend them off. The X-Men choose Serafina to the vault, and the only way to get in is to have Sync, Darwin, and X-23 go in after her, but they get stuck in there for years and are missing. I think that was actually X-Men 4 and 5, because I don't think both things were happening at once. Matter of fact, I'm going to give myself credit for that, and then add one to the Marvel, because I think that was two issues. Because the summit was with the X-Men and the humans was one issue. Marauders 19 at Mandapur. Kitty sneaks ashore to open up a Kryconian gateway to let Callisto, Maro, Doc, Hump, Brute, and Bliss to fight off the Reavers. They are not politically allowed to dock. The homies Varadi, which are a bunch of kids, and Shen Zhao, who's the woman that tried to kill her husband, are raising hell in Mandapur to try to restructure it, like regenification or whatever they call it. Which is a bad term, because it usually means kick out the poor and bring in the rich. We have a Night Terrors Graveyard Moon. Number one, this is a Storm King. In the future, the rich can afford to be buried on the moon on Jupiter. This is Steve Niles for sure. The crew decides to form a coup and steal all the values from the dead, but the dead come back to life to get their revenge. It's a very interesting take, a very Steve Niles, if you know how he paces things and sort of starts and wraps things up. Noctura number 4. And I told you I was going to lose my voice. In the future, only the rich can well, I already talked about that. M has changed, but Val finds the Flash that temporarily restores his thinking. Val is the brother to M that is sort of getting the disease to turn himself into a night monster. They get to the destination to see a flower as they're welcomed by the grandpa's dead brother. Meanwhile, the villain is chasing them. We have Blood and Bullets. This is number one, a Kickstarter, 5 out of 5. Bloody Mary comes back home to vi this is a Western to visit her brother. Her brother has 2 kids from a previous marriage and now lives with a new wife who is a Native American that the town hates. They racially hate this woman, but he loves her. But the 2 kids don't, I don't think they get along with her too well. Two brothers and sister open up a bar in town and are only seen at night, which is weird. One night, the brother is working late and hears screaming in the alley, so he runs out there and sees a bunch of vampires killing a townsperson, and then he is killed by a spear of the vampires. Now Bloody Mary seeks revenge, but she does not know she is up against vampires. We then get G.I. Joe, a real American hero. G.I. Joe is there, number 111 and 112. Cobra Commander, along with Zamot and Tomax, take over Benzene in the Middle East. The Emir has escaped and is now with the Joes. The Ninja Force is going to spy on Cobra. Stalker's group is protecting them and serving as a comm with Flint and Lady Jane as backup. Flint and Lady Jane captured by the Fayuda Webble Fighter. And then Cool Breeze comes up with an idea to help notify Ninja Force that they are being watched. Stalker gives him shit, but goes along with the plan and gives up their position to Cobra. Cool Breeze makes a sacrifice to save the Joes, but is rescued by Scarlet, Snake Eyes, and Storm Shadow, only to be killed by Stalker's gun as he jumps in front of a bullet meant for Stalker. So, you remember I talked about Fayud? Well, Fayud is captured by the Joes, but as he's captured, Fayud goes and grabs Stalker's gun to shoot Stalker, and Cool Breeze, who this new character that is a comm type related G.I. Joe, who I liked a lot, is killed. So at first he was going to sacrifice himself to save the Joes because he felt responsible, and then he does save Stalker later on, who Stalker's always giving him shit. So he saves his life, jumps in front of the bullet meant for Stalker. Viper is bragging about killing a lot of Joes, but Ninja Force takes him out. That's interesting because this Viper brags to like Cobra Commander, and Cobra Commander doesn't kill him. Like he talks rudely to Cobra Commander, and I'm like, Cobra Commander should just kill this motherfucker, but he doesn't want to kill him because he knows he's a badass. So that's how that goes. But let's see if I have any more notes on that. Breaker, Quick Kick, Heavy Metal, Thunder, Crazy Legs, Crankcase, and Doc were all dead and buried by Viper. So he killed a lot. I'm aware of Quick Kick. I'm aware of Heavy Metal and Breaker, but I'm not. I don't remember Thunder, Crazy Legs, Crankcase. And Doc sounds familiar. But yeah, really cool. G.I. Joe, a real American hero. So there we go, and that'll wrap us up. We took care of 3 weeks because I was behind. I'll never catch up, but we're already hitting September, and I have all of August and 1 more week and a half of July. So unless I do another episode in another week, catch up 3 weeks. I don't think I'll ever get caught up. But that's good. I still have something to talk about. Matter of fact, I have to still log all the books I read last week. And I hope I remember them because I was lazy and my parents were here and I was reading them. I usually go to the computer and then log, while it's fresh in my head. Well, in this one, I'm going to have to kind of wing it. And I read a lot of 5 out of 5s. Like I read another 2 issues of Gung Ho. I read Radiant Black. I read some more Spawn. I read another Karma, which was amazing. But anyway, I want to thank you for listening. Please let me know what you think of the episodes and send questions at any time. You can reach me at mike@comicbooknoise.com. You can send me email at mike. Well, that is mike@comicbooknoise.com. You can send me tweets at Mike Myers Brunch on Twitter, and that's Mike and then MYERS Brunch. That's a good way to get a hold of me. You can go to the website at geekbrunchpodcast.com, leave a comment there. I will see it. And if it's legit, I will post it. And then you could also get a hold of me on Facebook at Geek Brunch Podcast. Click the like and follow all the Geek Brunch Podcast threads there. And you can also follow me at DCNoisePodcast.com or DC Noise Podcast. Click the like button on Facebook. And I want to thank you guys for listening, and we'll talk to you soon. Peace out.